chime go off right when I'm about to say something important. It doesn't happen every meeting, but hopefully we have a meeting today that has the interest of many, and it's a subject that this committee's dealt with in 2007. Hasn't been subjected to this issue quite as much as the rest of us on this committee. But we did deal with a lot of issues around the construction industry and dealt with the Construction Claims Task Force, which made some recommendations to the legislature aimed at protecting consumers from shoddy construction and protecting their financial interests in dealing with construction contractors. So we had a lot of different proposals, a lot of different recommendations this committee looked at and reviewed a lot of different problems that basically are pretty broad, and it's a real difficult topic to get your head around sometimes because there's a lot of different agencies that do come into regulating our industry. One of the, of course, the most important ones is the Construction Contractor Board in regulating this industry. We are going to start out with the CCB and Craig Smith, and we have some testimony after that from some in the industry itself. And then we're going to look at one of the issues around the industry as work being performed by people who aren't licensed or people that are improperly licensed or who are employees and shouldn't be referred to as independent contractors. We did have some testimony as well in the Business and Labor Committee on some issues around that subject as well. I really wanted to focus on the construction industry this morning, and hopefully we'll get a nice presentation of some of the issues we're looking at and give us this committee some food for thought on whether or not we want to pursue any more legislative action in this particular venue. So with that, I guess brief introduction, I'd like to have Craig Smith from the Construction Contractor Board start us off with a little bit of review of what we did do in terms of it, you know, briefly in terms of the construction claims task force recommendations and some of the things that we didn't do. And start off our discussion with that. So thank you very much, committee members, for showing up, and thank you, Craig, for making yourself available. I know you've got a tight schedule, so we'll go ahead and get started.
Shareholder members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board, thank you for accommodating that schedule. And it's really exciting, frankly, for us to be here and for you to provide and work today. I was telling Gina that it was really strange drive, never seen anything like it. If you're coming from down south, the rain was on the west, the rainbows were there, the beautiful sunrise coming up, and literally, as I'm coming into work, I'm driving through the middle of the rainbow. And so we're going home after this and looking for the possibility. Let me prepare for you. We do have a little brochure or a handout that should be in front of you, very similar to what you saw last time, but it's been updated. And I'm going to kind of keep an eye on each of you and try to figure out what you're interested in. Please, answer questions that you have. Other than that, I'll just do a review and follow this program, which is a review of the 2007 legislation that passed the Texas Construction Contractors Board, a progress report on implementation of some of that legislation, an update on the CCB continuing education system, which is huge. I think it's an envelope and other education that contractors will be going through in the years to come. Also, something I think you may be interested in is our ability to, our effort to try to educate consumers, which we believe is huge in terms of trying to answer both the unlicensed contractor and perhaps the, some of the underground economy. We have a DVD we'd love to play for you if you have a chance to look at that. We already took an action in Portland where the media covered it on Craigslist. Craigslist is a place where I don't know guys my age will understand that. It was much more perhaps than other folks, but that is commonly used to look for business services, as you may well know. And we get a lot of complaints from our licensed contractors about illegal activity on textbooks. We think that consumers are unfortunately drawn to this, particularly younger consumers. In fact, several things we're doing to try to address that issue and think that we might be effective. Also have an area here about what legislation didn't pass. Get an opportunity to talk about that. And then if there's time, we'll talk about the legislative concept. And I must be frank with you, we did more last session than we've done in 20 years in traditional regulation in this industry. There may be more to do. But CCB is not bringing the two of this one. We have several legislative concepts, most of them are streamlining issues, fine-tuning issues. There also could be vehicles, quite frankly, that could be moved for vehicles to other regulations and issues and things like that. We don't have a very aggressive consumer protection agenda for our legislative concepts this year. So with that, I will tell you that the 2007 legislature, the 74th legislative assembly, brought a lot of changes. They were driven by three different forces. Legislation brought to you by the Construction Contractors Board, a chart of which is, you can see that legislation on the page one. They were divided into Senate bills and House bills. They included everything from increased bonding to talking about the King Price problem and everything in between. Many of those bills passed or were made part of other bills that passed. And again, that chart will help describe that. I won't go into detail on those things unless you want to, but I will tell you that when you turn to page two, you will see the details of those bills, what happened to them, how they passed or they didn't pass, what they do, and they're broken into three areas. Consumer protection bills, which are on page two and top of page two, including increased financial accountability for larger banks. Minimum contract standards. The task force and construction plan, as well as CCP, had bills on this. The amalgamation of both funded in specific minimum contract risk requirements for residential construction contracts. Requirements to keep copies of the consumer notices. This is huge. When you have these notices, contractors are obligated to provide. And the bill from the task force took a little different tack to allow the contractor to write rules. Board has written rules. The rules require not only for those notices that you have copies of, but even in the past, we have them in the back and we have them in the front. They have to keep those proof that they delivered those for 2 years. This isn't universally loved by contractors. They have to keep all that ready. But of course, it is very important for the contractors. There's also a requirement for contractors to let us know if they have court judgments because of that. The requirements of contractors to, there's two bills that didn't pass in the middle of page three that we may want to talk about further. The first one has to do with bankruptcy. The current regulatory scheme attempts to address contractor regulation by holding the individuals who run the business accountable for the behavior of that business. But frankly, the right of the person to file bankruptcy provides us challenges with that. And by that I mean that different contractors in business develop a lot of construction debt, and when individuals flee that business, don't pay their workers, don't pay their consumers, don't pay other contractors, don't pay suppliers, and they file bankruptcy, you can't keep them out of business. So we were looking for a way to address that problem, frankly, we haven't done it yet. Maybe that's something that needs to be revisited. The other issue has to do with the pay price problem. That received some news media this last month. We didn't bring that to you to the other side, I believe, but this was a situation of a young contractor, top 30 company, who kind of had a mediocre drive. I mean, he really went fast in terms of paying almost nothing for several years, 5 or so, doing fantastic work in a wonderful home, but it was extended. And as a result, now he owes hundreds of thousands of dollars to consumers and others based upon CCP orders. And there are some cases where this individual received money from the consumer to pay their damages, to pay the contract price, and then did not pay the suppliers. That's a pretty hard problem. is consistent with this guideline. And that to appear from a legitimate interest of sovereigns and such to say, look, I deserve to be paid once. That's all I want to do is be paid once. But the way we structured the lien law today puts consumers at risk. I'm not sure if it's consistent with what you're saying. Maybe it is, but if you want to revisit that issue and talk about solving the case, that's probably the most simple thing. Increased contract accountability, bottom page 3. We went through several bills, many of them passed, and we made part of the process of reflecting funds bills. The one that did not pass required contractors to notify CCB that they were necessary to lose their insurance. This is important to us because if the contractor loses their insurance, sometimes we're not made aware. Now that bill, like a little surprise, it was a technical problem. So good news is it was able to get the funds. We took that one, whereas I voted within the committee, it was stuff was a problem that another member had, had a personal issue that was voted a draft policy issue of responding the installation of barrier, exterior insulation system. So I took the stuff out. So that's all we're doing for that purpose in class. Other miscellaneous bills and housekeeping measures are at the bottom of page 4. In that case, it's just not for a construction price. So a reference friend or others who may not be entirely familiar, this is a situation where about getting close to 4 or 5 years now, we've got a tremendous problem in this state that both consumers and contractors are facing that has been successfully tested by the insurance. That culminated in taking, again, a CCD bill to House Bill 2078 for 2005 flooding maintenance and stopping it through the leadership of the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Homeland Ministry. These partners have come up with the creation of what was then known as the Task Force on Construction Claims. That task force met during the year 2006, did some fantastic work, came up with many bills that were recommended by the 2007 legislature to go through the process. I'm thinking about legislation that's a lot of new debate. You know, sometimes we talk about legislation that's a little bit like making sense. We think about it. But I was thinking of moving, like really making a movie. You have a lot of footage that you take, but there are certain things that end up on the federal floor. At the end of the day, hopefully you have a great movie. Hopefully you have great legislation. But they're not going to have a chance to change the place. Some of the recommendations in the part of the Task Force on Construction Claims passed through. Others were modified. Others were left on the cutting table. And so we're here to talk a little bit about that and what's wrong and what should be really corrected as well. Keith's staff addressed him and his folks over the Court Division, and he can talk in more detail about it now. But the task force is your task force based on your legislation and with good results in many important bills that were considered by the Senate. Among them was House Bill 2064. That ultimately became what was known as Superbook. Many of the concepts from the task force on construction claims was integrated into that one bill at the end of the day. A summary of those items on page 6 that affect the CCB. They go everywhere from the continuing education requirement to a new law prohibiting liens if there is no written contract, the standard contract terms, a variety of other issues that improve protection for consumers as well as help keep contractors accountable for their business practices. The chart on page 6 you saw before, but it's been updated. It also shows the staff work by CCB to bring some of these issues to full development, the administrative rules, and educating contractors and all. The detail of those are contained on page 7. And unless you want to spend a lot of time on those, I'll just rush through that. That takes us to the other big bill that, again, we're probably not going to spend a lot of time, but I got to tell you really what our work, and that was House Bill 3242. House Bill 3242 on page number 14 was the partnership bill from the Association of General Contractors and the Building Trade Council. This is the bill that separated contractors into commercial and residential type contractors. And we were very thankful that they allowed us to work with them to try to make it as palatable for all licensees as possible. And we did that by trying to make sure there's only one license, not two. That was important because it could be confusing if there's no one license. And to keep the cost down. And we did that. With that said, you have to, as I'm here to report to you, that there's still some pushback. There will be a bit of pushback from the industry as they start to realize that they have to make a choice whether they're going to be a residential contractor or a commercial contractor or both. There will be additional costs to be a commercial contractor, but they're not terrible. They're additional bonds. And what I've seen for the additional bond for the commercial work is not that helpful. Experiences the insurance company. Prerequisite experience. Contractors getting this license, this commercial license, they have to demonstrate through a self-certification that they have experience in the trade of construction before they're able to acquire a commercial license. There will also be continuing education requirements. And there's some requirements that go beyond that for a lot of people. But you may see this in front of you this summer. There is some pushback there, a little bit of pressure. With that said, we have been successful in changing our database, changing our funds, and getting new surety bonds developed so the products are there and contractors are acquiring that license as you see. That began in July. And we've got about 500 contractors now that have these new contractor endorsements. 500 of the 46,000. I think that is the useful, if I can, draw your attention to these charts so you have some idea of what we're dealing with in terms of volume of contracts. I mentioned to you that some of 500, and some of the people today, as of 1 month into this endorsement law, have changed from the endorsement to time. What this chart shows you, when the title seems to be licensing at 50 years, it gives you an indication of how many contractors you have licensed over the course of the last 8 years, and whether they have been tested or not tested. I'm sorry, that's the next slide. This one shows whether they're active or inactive. An inactive license is one where the contractor pays their fees, but is not authorized to work. And you can see that we hit a low back in 2003. We went down to just below 41,000 contractors, and quite frankly, at that rate, we cannot fund the entire industry. We have had more contractors in the most recent years, and we're at the level where we're actually banking money, which is huge. And now we're starting to decline again. And I don't have to tell you about the issues and challenges in the construction industry, particularly in the construction industry. But we expect some additional restriction in the non-licensed contractors. Just for your information, again, the other charts there shows how many contractors are tested. We instituted a testing requirement beginning in 2000. The other contractors that were there at that time were grandfathered in. But as we go through the years, the grandfathers retire, the new blood kicks in, and we have more tested contractors than we get. The next slide is the complaints filed by you, and this is our dispute resolution program. This is the program where a consumer files against the contractor. The interesting thing about this slide is how we had a lot of complaints 5 years ago, and it drastically went down in 2004. It went further down in 2005, and it just started to creep back up. But I can tell you, when the economy goes south, we have more complaints. Last, I wanted to show you the screen on our enforcement activity. The difference between the dispute and enforcement is enforcement has to do with non-licensed contracts. There are other violations of the regulations. And you can see that we have been kind of bouncing back and forth between about 2,000 and 3,000 for several years. mentioned to you previously, thankfully, why it seems to be a different resource this last session that allowed us to put out these interviews. And it just here's the result of the number of complaints that the open network has had. That's the program statistics. And I will not go into the details on the commercial law. I do have a screenshot about the, again, some of the footage that was left on the cutting room table. I'd like to talk about that. But with your permission, I'd like to talk to you further right now about our progress on continuing education in the middle school. With your permission, I'll introduce Jim Fox, our public information officer and also contractor and consumer education manager, Ms. Fox.
Thank you. Just before you say, I want to give a brief update to the continuing education program that we're establishing. The goal of the Continuing Education Committee and the agency is to be able to present a draft plan to the board at the October meeting. We hope this plan will be a complete foundational plan for our continuing education system and for all contractors. Even though the plan is still in draft form, it's highly likely that it's going to consist of 8 hours of continuing education every year, 16 hours on the licensing period, which is every 2 years. We believe that it will have 3 hours hours dedicated to building envelope construction. We believe that 2 hours will be in building codes and 3 hours will be in business practices. Those consist of the 8 hours. We expect that the other 8 hours will be more elective type of classes, which can cover anything from manner means, green building, sustainability, energy efficiency, and it can also take in any of the hours from the building envelope or building codes and business practices. So we expect that that will be kind of the basic foundation of the continuing education. We also anticipate taking the basic building envelope and integrating it into a prerequisite education program, so that will be something that all contractors get when they come into the business. We're looking at, it's highly likely that there's going to be some kind of voluntary process for building envelope training, such as in roofing, insiding, and windows installation. And we're expecting that piece to go down to the employee level. Our committee is planning to meet every month until the board meets in October, so we have a lot of planning time on this. And included in the packet is some really rough rules that we're going to be presenting to the committee at our next meeting on August 4th. So we'll have those. I'm sorry, I did not mention Joe on this committee. On the committee, the chair is Richard Lewis. He is a member of the Community Association of Urban Members. And the other two committee members are Rob York and Rob Fernandez, both members of the CCB board and contractors representing both commercial and residential companies.
This is a subcommittee of the Conceptual Contracting Board. Yes. And I'm wondering if you just told members, committee members, that the rules, the very draft rules are on page 25. Especially if the chairman says that is not
right. I also like to just education survey of all licensed contractors. We ran two surveys in our last 2 newsletters, one was in March and one was in June. And we received response back. It's probably about a 2% response rate back from contractors, asking them, getting their input on what do they think of the number of hours, you know, what do they think of what types of classes would be most beneficial to them. We really wanted to get their input on what the program would look like. Those results are in the packet, and we did open it up for those comments. And just so you know, about almost all of the surveys we receive back, everyone has comments. And it's a mixed bag. We have some contractors who are thinking this is a good thing, and we need it. And there's other contractors who wish it's a good thing. And so, you know, we have a mixed bag, but we really needed to have the input and some of the some really good input and insights so that we can take that back to the community.
Before we get to the items that were left on the table of last legislation for technical communication, that concludes our presentation on the communication system progress report. If you're ready, we'll give you some information on what we're doing to reach out to the consumers.
Let me just take a step back on the education piece. Of course, really excited about any education bill on the industry. One of the issues, as you know, is around the education piece. It was not specifically a task force recommendation the way it was implemented with educating contractors. And I had a hand that got my communication from Eric Grassberg, who was the chair of that task force, and was pretty disappointed that House Bill 2656 that was left on the table, which was an education piece or a certification piece that you had a qualified installer on the project. And there was a big difference between certifying a contractor and certifying someone on the job. And so that, you know, that was always an issue, of course, as you know, that was. I spent a lot of time trying to work with trying to come to consensus on it, which, you know, we came pretty close to, but for whatever reason the bill didn't make it through the Ways and Means process. But we didn't have quite as much support there as we But I guess part of my question around that is now that you've administratively done this education piece for contractors, Harry Grassberg has sent us a letter that saying that he doesn't see was pretty vocal about being dissatisfied with that approach. I'm just curious how long you think it'll take before we see the results of that education getting into the field where it's going to have an impact on the building envelope being done properly. Because it does take a while. I mean, it's one thing to have the owner of the company know how the building envelope should be constructed and put together and how it should work. It's quite something different out in the field where you have somebody doing the job who may not understand anything about it. So how do we get from the owner down to the guy who's doing the work?
It's a couple of questions there. Let me take the last one first, and that is how do we get the training down to the grassroots for things to happen? And I think that you've heard this in the past, but I think that it makes some sense. And that is to use a model that I think is used in the OSHA industry, in the safety industry, where you do train somebody in the building or somebody in the business, but that person is obligated and must somehow certify or otherwise provide proof that they train people in their business to go back and train their people. And I think that's doable. I think that that could be affordable. Will that work? Is that the same as having a four-year apprenticeship for a plumber? Well, no, it's not. It's not the same thing as having a regulation that we haven't signed in the legislature. But it certainly would be a vast improvement over what we have today, which is actually not. So the answer, I think, is we come up with a program that, first of all, every contractor has to be educated in what the building envelope is, how important it is to the lasting nature of that structure. Even if a person's laying tiles, they can hurt the building envelope by not paying attention to what they're doing. Even if a person is just an excavation contractor, there's an argument that can be made that they need to understand what the building envelope is, that they play a part in seeing to it, that at the end of the day, they're construction equipment or whatever they're doing doesn't interfere with the rainproofness or the waterproofness of the exterior structure. So I will be trying to sell to the board that every contractor, or maybe a very small few of them, but most of the contractors should have some experience, some training in what they're doing on their fields, and they'd be obligated to go back to their employees. About 40% of all contractors have employees. About 60% are single employees. 40% have employees. So if we can get 60% to actually go through this training themselves, and on the other 40% have an obligation to take the training and somehow certify it times a year, they've taken back a package. Maybe it's a DVD. Maybe it's something else. But they certify that they train their people. I think that's a step forward. And then perhaps down the road, there might be some interest in being included in that. But that's something we can do today. The second question was, when are we going to see results? So, and it's fine to talk, but when are you going to get down to results? And I'm going to punt on this. I can't tell you. I think it's intuitive that trucking is going to happen. But when we're all done, it's going to stop construction defects. It won't stop them, but it will reduce them. It's always been my testimony to you that the most important thing we can do is to hold the owners accountable for the poor work of their people. That's what makes construction defects go away, is if I can take a contractor to build it, continue to operate after they've done poor work or hired others to do poor work, we'll start to extinguish that bad work. Another way to go is what we're talking about, which is like changing for them. And that is, let's make sure that the workers are paid. And that's fine. But I got to tell you, it's my experience as a construction contractor that I've trained my people. That was 25 years ago. But I didn't let them, and a good contractor doesn't let a homeowner be exposed to somebody who's going to screw up. It's not in their best interest. It's not in the consumer's best interest. So most contractors are already trained. What we need to do is extinguish the incentive on contractors to do the wrong thing, which is to go down to the mission and pick up some people that otherwise are not trained and have them do fairly skilled labor. That we have to stop. And you're going to find, I think, with your next presentation, that the issue on independent contractors may have to go after the underground economy to help that as well as this plan. So the answer is, it's going to be years. But I would suggest to you that we're already seeing some accountability on the part of contractors. I think we're seeing some lessening in the amount of defective construction. And we'll see less than we have this education program put together in a couple of years.
Well, if you want to proceed from there.
Okay. Then we'll take you to what we're doing to reach out to consumers. Again, I know I'm mindful that you've got other folks here that are more important than what we have, and so I'd like to go through this, but I would cherish an opportunity to play a little DVD with your first few weeks. So, with your permission, we'll set that up, and I will tell you about it. But I indicated to you that we've got a problem with Craigslist. Craigslist is an online process for the world that you don't know or any others that don't know. It's where you can go as an individual, sign up, and advertise for work. And in the Eugene area, in the Portland area, we have a lot of folks complain, who are licensed contractors, what are you doing about Craigslist? Well, we're doing a lot of different things. One of the things we're doing as a staff is going out on Craigslist and busting some of these folks. It's hard to get to them because they don't have an address, they don't have an email, they don't have that. So we're doing a variety of things online to go after those. The other thing we did, and this happened about the last time that we met in Portland, we, with the help of a local news outlet in Portland, set up, for lack of a better word, a little stand. So we got a house, we set it up with cameras, or at least the news folks did, and we made some calls on Craigslist. And I'm being upstaged, so maybe I'll let the report talk for itself.
And what they found is in just one day, a string of contractors willing to break the law put you at risk. You might need some support driveway, or look at that patio. Richard could be your guy. Break otherwise get filled.
An unlicensed contractor, sorry, you just got hit by an uninsured driver, so to speak. He drives off, leaving you holding the bag.
The construction contractor's rule set up this state to catch people willing to set you up for trouble. The investigator says the state uncovered 8 illegal contractors in just one day.
You have to succeed license all the way down.
Richard Ta'utu'a'a confesses right away. He's been caught before, just 2 weeks ago, when the state says he received a $1,000 fine for working without a license. We asked him about the state.
Are you doing pretty good?
You think that what they're doing is a good idea?
No, it can be good when they're not together.
But Richard is one of many making money at your expense. Why don't you have a license? Warren Gregerson was fined before. Not everyone has that attitude. Richard Anderson and Bam Cobain showed up at the same time.
It's not coming back to a license contract.
Both claim to be working under a license. The state investigator says both are not, leaving you unprotected.
I'm not sure I make life difficult.
The state investigator hopes illegal contractors will license up. Customers will check out their contractors so they don't end up with someone like this. John, who claims to be legit.
I can call whoever owns that license right now while you talk to Mr. Woods and find out if you're authorized or not. I know exactly where they're at right now. They're working on the coast, and I know they're not going to answer because I tried to get a hold of them today. I can leave a message. Yeah.
John won't tell, and it turns out his license number is shut down with complaints, fines, and unpaid bills.
I'd like to withdraw my shoulder.
Okay, it's considerably
job. I need to get my copy back.
Yes, sir.
Oh, you're going to get it back to me.
If he does a bad job, you, the customer, are stuck with it.
So you're going to have to pay for everything.
Now, tomorrow night in this thing, we'll show a contractor who came around the corner just in time to see another contractor getting busted. He left, but came back again and got caught himself. Plus, we have tips for you on how you can protect yourself at GoogleTV.com. In the newsroom, Carrie Tomlin said, the 10 o'clock news. And if you have a story for the Fox 12 investigators, we'll be live back.
Let's go ahead and cut that last one. Well, and again, you don't have enough time to go through all of this, but I wanted to give you a flavor for what we're doing. You can see that one of our tasks, and this is a good intro to what we're headed towards with consumer education, is to make it clear to consumers that when you go out and contract for cheap and try to find the very cheapest price possible, particularly when you're dealing with folks that aren't licensed, it's a false economy. If you can dry up the demand for unlicensed activity, or at least heighten the demand for licensed activity, we're going to be ahead of the game. And this helps us. This is like this is $100,000 of advertising, and we get the news media to do this. And as you all know, the news media sometimes does the opposite kind of reporting on the activities the government does, and that's fine too. That's fine too. Give them credit for that. But this is a nice one. I wanted to share it with you.
Well, thank you. I think that was a really good piece of advertising for you, and I'm real happy to see that you're out there trying to crack on some of the unlicensed contractors and things like that. And that's tough for people that are legitimate to compete. So that kind of brings up a question that I have, though. And what if you have an individual that's got a construction license or doesn't have a construction license that is operating a company doing this kind of work, and they get fines on violations, or they get in a situation where they haven't paid their bills, and, you know, obviously we talked about them filing bankruptcy, and I'm aware that the state can't refuse to give them a new license if they form a new corporation. But, I mean, at what point do we take these individuals that are doing this, that are repeatedly showing up and breaking the law, at what stage are we hold them responsible or accountable and say, we're not going to give you a license anymore? Or when do we hold responsible another contractor who hires somebody who isn't licensed. And what kind of liability or accountability do they have?
Great questions. First, let's talk about what happens if a contractor hires an unlicensed contractor. They will get fired. Common for us to run across a contractor who has mistakenly hired somebody that day, whose license either expired or was suspended because of longer insurance coverage. We find that commonly. We also less commonly find contractors, and this is more insidious and more of a problem, who hire folks under the table. Those are the ones who do want to get both of them. And they're both can be subject to $1,000 civil penalty on the first offense, $5,000 on the subsequent offenses, and revocation of license if they do it repeatedly. But it's this underground economy that cannot be tolerated. And again, I guess I want to set up my friends in the back who are about ready to talk to you about the independent contractor law, because it is this behavior where contractors are hiring people under the table that is killing legitimate contractors. It's putting workers at risk, and it can't let this go on. And so we'll talk more about that. But the answer to your question, shareholder, is that the first time we find them in terms of hiring an unlicensed contractor, we get $1,000. Those contractors, or those individuals, who have no respect for government. They're just criminals. They're not contractors. I call them contractors masquerading as criminals, masquerading as contractors. We have a progressive discipline approach. That means we'll give a civil penalty first, we'll give a civil penalty second. If those things aren't paid, we aggressively collect those. We'll put liens on any property owned by the individual. We'll go after their tax refunds. We will go after anything we can, including garnishment, which we can identify in the individuals. If that doesn't work, we can get an injunction with the help of our friends at DOJ. Injunctions have to do with an unlawful trade practice act. Violations of the Unlawful Trade Practice Act can result in an injunction. And the power of an injunction is that if that is violated again, it's immediate incarceration because you're violating a judge's order. We've been successful in getting some of those in the past. We have relationships with folks over at the Financial Fraud Section of the Department of Justice, financial arrangements so that we pay for some of their work. They're very, very happy to do it with us and catch the right guys. We also work with local law enforcement because at the end of the day, if a contractor wants to avoid and not pay attention to government regulations, you have to put people in jail, particularly if they're stealing money, taking money and not doing their work. This is a challenge for us because we are at the disposal of the local district attorney. You've heard me say this before. Sometimes they're overworked. Some counties you have better luck than others. But we do have a section of our enforcement compliance section that is dedicated towards these what we call special investigations. And we have relationships both with DAs and local police. And when we catch folks that are running around, we turn to turn travelers and make it this before. News media, I think it was them as well, to get paving scams. Paving scams are a typical traveler type activity. Traveler is an organized criminal activity that goes from state to state and does various kinds of scams. One of the scams is laying hard colored asphalt. This looks like you've got an individual who runs by the house and says, look, I've got some outdated materials, and I can get it to you at cost, so I don't have to call it home. Do it for $1,200, and you can go after an elderly victim. That person doesn't even take the time because it looks like such a good deal. They don't check the time to check to see if the person is not licensed. They lay the asphalt, and quite often, what the bad guy does is go back to the citizen and say, oh, did I say $1,200? I meant $1,500. No, I meant $12,000. They'll go as far as they possibly can to try to weasel the money out of the citizen. It's just fraud, it's just theft, and we've been successful in trying to get those local law enforcement and others involved in contracts. And that goes from state to state. You're going to see a little bit about the independent contractor working, how that can work in the state. So is this travel. But I really appreciate that for your time.
Thank you, Craig. I think you've really set the stage for this issue. And see if questions on the screen.
Yes, I'm looking at your complaints here. Especially complaint rate? Is that anything to the consumer rate score? And then what is the percentage of sound that they're going to get?
Chair Holder, that's a Springer. Great question. I understand today what exactly is a complaint and what's the percentage of sound versus non-sound.
Think of these as a small civil court proceeding where almost any citizen that's doing business with a construction contractor can file a complaint against the licensed contractor alleging that the contractor didn't do work in accordance with its contract. So half of those are consumer complaints. The other half comes from workers who haven't been paid, subcontractors who have not been paid, material suppliers who have not been paid. And all of those then are processed like any kind of a civil proceeding against that contractor's license. About half the time, we're able to work out some kind of a written agreement with the complainant and the contractor, where the contractor makes good. Sometimes it's a good faith dispute. There's expectations of the part of the consumer. There is expectations of the part of the contractor. The contractor has to endure this, and we're able to try to make that contract more flushed out and make more parties happy. That's something the best we can do. It is expensive, but it really helps both sides. From time to time, you have contractors who just have either bad will, they're doing it badly on purpose, or they end up financially in trouble. Not able to finish the job or whatever. In a situation like that, we cannot bring that to the problem to closure, and that is then disputed against that contractor's license in the form of a money judgment that justice goes against the contractor and is payable by a bond. Half the time, the bond is sufficient to pay that debt. Half the time, when we get all the way down to the end of the day, this is about 100 or 150 complaints a year, the bond is not that high. We raised the bond by 30% this last year, from $15,000 to $20,000 for a final contract. As to your specific question as to how many are founded and how many are not founded, about 25% of the complaints we get are not within our jurisdiction. I believe the number is 25% turn out to be not founded. The other 50%, there's some merit to, sometimes it's a basis to. So about 50% of the time we actually are able to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Craig, you just brought something to mind, which was another piece that was left on the table for consumers, and that was the assistance great conversation. I don't know if consumers who do get stuck at the end of the day where the bond doesn't cover their losses. Do you see that there's still a hole there that exists, or still a need to figure out some way to make sure consumers don't unduly get financially punished by a bad actor in that instance?
Chair Holby, I think that question is, would it be a benefit? Would it be a good public policy to have a different protection for consumers? And I say yes. I can't come here today and tell you that it's only what it was response. But I think the idea is a sound one. It's controversial. You know, it's not universally accepted from a lot of different sources. Any kind of getting the government involved and holding a pot of money, you know, can be a little bit tough. And that's what we're talking about here. Selecting a pot of money to be distributed to consumers and the advance of the compliance. But you recall the idea that you heard before, which is, I think, very unique. And that's taking a portion of the fine line that you heard that before. We collect about $500,000 per year. For biennium, who I think about that per year. And that money goes to general fund. Now, we're not bringing you to the cuff yet. But if you want to further discuss that, I can talk with the administration about how to pick up your money.
Thank you. I'm going to move on, lift you off the hot seat. I really appreciate you coming before my committee once again. And of course, we're discussing on these issues a bit more as we're able to stick on the business and other aspects of the issues that we're doing this morning. Next up, I'd like to switch gears a little bit, and let's talking to a couple of people from the industry who have had problems with some of the topics we're talking about. And Bradley Cook, contractor, who has taken it upon himself to inform the CCB and others of some issues he's come across in his line of work.
Thank you, Chairman Holden, for inviting me.
Your perspective on this topic.
My name is Bradley Cook, and I'm a small business owner. That's how I identify myself now. I don't around people call myself a contractor. It's not a name that I don't feel proud of anymore. The contracting business, as it is conducted today, is all about grabbing as much money as possible from everybody else we can. There's little oversight, and so there's little protection for the consumer or a level playing field for those who play by the rules. It's like going to jail. There are the warden's rules and those that must be obeyed, and then there are the unwritten rules of the prison yard. Learning how to hide your money in the contracting world is like learning how to hide your shank or contraband in prison. If a company is not licensed, it can underbid a legitimate company easily by 6-7% just on what is saved on payroll expenses. When figuring the various payroll taxes and associated insurance, we figure our cost is about 25% of our payroll. When one gets into the thousands of dollars worth of work, someone gets a pricing advantage here and is not the legitimate contractor. Time and time again, I hear from clients that I'm the only contractor that hands out consumer protection notices. And by the way, I just laid off, or I had an employee of mine quit because of lack of work. I had 20 employees at the beginning of this year, and I currently have 9, which is going to translate at the end of the year to a loss in taxes paid to the state of Oregon and to the federal government of about $70,000. Small peanuts in the big picture, but I'm just one business. As a member of the Lane County Home Builders Association, the home builders continue to use a contractor who didn't have a license for 8 months, even when I made them aware of, including Mike Danson, lobbyist for the Lane County Home Builders Association here in Salem. When I look at the phone book for a doctor, let's back up a minute. If we all just moved here to Salem, and we moved from across the country, and we think to ourselves, well, let's see, I need a doctor, I need a dentist, I need a vet for the dog, and I need to hire a contractor to put a fence around my yard for my dog. We assume that when we open up this phone book here, that all these people are licensed and are legit. Enforcement of this should fall under consumer protection. If I don't pay my bond or my liability insurance, the CCB websites informs consumers. The phone companies should disconnect the phone numbers of these unlicensed contractors. This came out last week. This is the deck section. There's no CCB number here. Here's the fence section. No CCB number. No CCB number. No number. No number. More than happy to bring it up to you so you can see it. This is just standard rules that we're supposed to have. We're supposed to have our CCB numbers on our cards, on our work vans, on all our advertising. And when the phone companies aren't even following these basic rules, how are we to compete? Phone books publishing unlicensed contractors actually went through these phone books about 4 months ago and presented it to Chairman Holby, all the findings that I had. And electricians, plumbers, drywall, fencers, deck, excavating, foundations, roofers, 10 to 20% of all the names in these phone books are unlicensed or suspended licensed contractors, and some going back as far as 1999. And year after year, the phone book continues. Why? Money. You make money off of this. Craigslist. Christina Olberg from the CCB came in and talked to me along with Robert Rambo.
That's 1 week. Just in Eugene. Here's another week. Look at them all. Look at them all. Here's another week. And another week.
That's how many of them are running around. And actually, from week one, there's a guy named Vern and Dave who advertised for painting. And I'm still seeing them. The first week was 6-5 of 08. Vern and Dave were advertising this morning still. What's being done? The Home Builders Association, I ran their members through. 13% of them were unlicensed. I was approached 4 years ago by Ed McMahon, Vice President of Lane County Home Builders Association, to join the Home Builders Association. I told Ed, you don't want me in the Home Builders Association because I'm a legit contractor and I know what goes on in the Home Builders Association. And he said, honestly, we know that's a problem and we're looking to clear it up. So he wanted to have a meeting with me. He invited Mike Ganson with him and two other members of the Home Builders Association. I invited a gentleman named Starr, who owns Oregon Fence, and I invited also State Senator Floyd Brzezinski, because I didn't want to be accused of mincing words or exaggerating truths. And I told Ed McMahon about these members of Home Builders Association and fencing that I knew were breaking the rules, that were unlicensed, and were paying under the table. And so he turns to the State Senator Brzezinski and says, or they talk together and say, can you have this person of this fence company come into your office tomorrow morning and show his workman's comp? This was on a Thursday. This fence contractor showed up on a Tuesday with a temporary workman's comp permit that was issued from the temp service that morning. He was busted. And so when I asked Ed McMahon, I said, are you going to kick him out? And he said, well, we just won't renew his membership when it comes due. I didn't like it. I grumbled, but I thought, okay, you got to give a little to get a little. When it came time for him to be renewed, he was renewed. And I called Ed up. I was furious. I said, you told me he was going to be kicked out. And he goes, oh, we made a clerical error. And I said, well, you're going to make a notation in the next newsletter that says you made a clerical error and refund his money back. Oh, we can't do that. He's still a member to this day, years later. And by the way, that same person, he 1099s all his employees. We've had two of his employees in the last 2 years come before me looking for a job. We're often putting our, up until the last few months, putting ads out in the paper looking for hired work. And we've heard the same story about this contractor, that these people coming to get a job from me are in horrible tax problems because they were 1099. They didn't realize, they thought it was great that they had extra money. This is what I'm up against every day. I will say the Oregonian, the Register Guard, do check and publish CCD numbers. For when you see call a professional, they bat a perfect 1,000. When we often advertise for help, we lose half of our applicants right off the bat because we don't pay under the table. People don't want to work for legitimate contractors. Again, here we hear stories from ex-employees about how other contractors conduct business. We take it with a grain of salt, but when two, three, four former employees approach us all the time with the same story, then we tend to believe what we hear is true. And one of the things that us licensed contractors, what we don't want to hear anymore is a lack of funding. if there's a lack of funding, raise our rates. We demand respect. And to conclude this, there are programs available out there, just like if I don't pay my CCD or my bond, that there'll be red flag right on the CCD website. There needs to be the same kind of programs available to general contractors that red flags their subs. I've seen too many, especially when I was joined Home Builders Association. I got one job in 2 years out of that, and I was supposed to be an organization network. And these people were using unlicensed contractors. And there's no excuse for it anymore. What I would like to see is the National Guard, if I'm to hire somebody, that I have to send them down to the employment agency and they issue the card, just like a credit card. And every week, I have to send in their hours to the state, the taxes that are taken out, and et cetera. And then an enforcement officer can just show up at random on any construction site and say, line up right here and present your cards. And everybody gets their cards swiped to see that they are legitimate and they're paying in the system. And if one person runs off that job site, then that job is shut down. There's got to be a way to close these loopholes for us legitimate contractors. And finally, I'd like to say, as harsh as this might sound, this is the bottom line. So I can conduct my business within the law and still be competitive, you all need to either start enforcing these laws or get them off the books and off my back.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. I think you made a pretty good point. Doing a legitimate business and have a pretty hard time competing with something that you talk about. I know that legislators and our agencies are serious about this and really are trying to grapple with how we can do something about the illegal activities in the industry and trying to further the plan of the
industry. One more thing, Chairman, I'd like to bring up too is about June 19th edition for everybody here, the June Weekly. You can go into the JuneWeekly.com. It's entitled Cutting Corners. Chairman Holby and State Senator Foy Kozlansky are in this article, and it's all about what we're talking about today. And I brought an extra copy and it's available to everybody here on that panel.
Thank you. Appreciate you making an effort to come up and tell us your perspective on this issue. With that, I'd like to bring up Steve Carlson. Issue, and I know you have been working on these issues for a while, both of you, and working in the industry, so if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Appreciate it, Chairman Holden, members of the committee. My name is Steve Carlson. I work for the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters as a service representative.
Looks like it. Also work as a representative for the Carpenters Union.
I appreciate you holding this hearing on construction issues and allowing us to testify this morning. I also appreciate Mr. Cook's testimony as a prior for us. He brings a lot of light to residential, which our membership really doesn't do much of that work. I mean, a fair piece of that is the fact that it can't be part of that profession in the economy. The issues of workers in the construction industry being employed incorrectly as independent contractors has been a problem in our industry for quite some time, and is becoming more prevalent in our observations. It's a problem which is difficult to prove and is underreported by workers for a variety of reasons. The misclassification of workers as independent contractors has some very adverse impacts on both workers and businesses. It also affects the standards we live and work by. This type of misclassification is part of a broader problem known as the underground economy, where workers are often paid in cash for all or part of the hours worked, or where workers are not paid properly for the hours worked. In addition, payments are often not made correctly on workers' compensation, unemployment insurance, payroll taxes, as well as income taxes and other benefits. It also puts workers in a position of being taken advantage of or exploited. This practice impacts the ability of contractors to comply with the law to compete fairly on projects and contracts throughout our state, across the Northwest region, and across our country. If this illegal practice is not stopped, more contractors will likely consider similar practices in order to compete and survive in the marketplace, no different than Mr. Cook has testified to. This will lead to further degradation of the entire industry, the quality of projects, and the standard of living for those of us that work in the construction industry. Oftentimes, contractors who cheat in this manner use several different companies to beat the system. They form new companies with new licenses and enforcing the violations force one of their companies out of business. We have information on such a contractor, Delta Drywall, an affiliated company owned by Christopher Croxa, who is licensed in the state of Oregon. More specifically on the issue of misclassifying workers as independent contractors and some of the ramifications, we would like to show a short video interview of a drywall worker who claims to be taken advantage of by Ron Russ Drywall using independent contractor status for many employees, and how that in turn is often accompanied by other abuses.
Thank you. So my name is Cliff Bucket. I'll show the video. You want to show it now?
Yeah.
What you see in this video is not unique. It represents what other people are on job sites daily. These stories we hear. This gentleman here was just upset enough and wanted to change it, and he came in and actually put on video for us. Say this was a unique story, but it's not. Our representatives hear these stories on a daily basis from job sites that we go on. Checking a contractor CCE license is the easiest way to find out if they're a legitimate contractor or even licensed. It's fairly easy to prove. But the underground economy has many more facets to it that are much, much harder to prove. This one contractor here employs almost all the tactics that a chief contractor would use. Cash payment to workers, non-payment of overtime, they are paid with a check, the overtime will be paid in cash, on top of 40 hours for a week. The use of illegitimate subcontractors. This one contractor here, Ron Russ, has a list of about 20 subcontractors that he uses to use drywall and metal service. You can go on one of his job sites and see four guys hanging sheetrock, and all four of them have their own contractor license. You can go by their shop, their business addresses, it's listed on their license, just their house, no materials, no equipment, just their house. They actually even use of labor brokers. The workers are forced to give kickbacks to the people that got them their jobs. All these are much harder to prove than just simply checking your contractor license. You have to give the CCB credit for the efforts that they're taking in cleaning up this industry. But the problem is much bigger than the CCB. That's why we need a multi-agency task force to go after these chief contractors. Most of the regulations that we need are currently in place. What we need is enforcement of those regulations. And hold those contractors that aren't living up to it task. More regulations are good. They're good for those contractors that are willing to play by the rules. Those contractors are going to cheat, they're going to cheat, no matter what regulations you try to put in place for them. Hope this gives you a little more insight into the severity of this problem, how broad it is, and how really we need to take steps to do that.
All the representatives, as Cliff stated, we recognize that enforcement in this area can be difficult and often takes collaboration between different agencies for enforcement to that agency's specific jurisdiction. We're encouraged that Oregon agencies sometimes cooperate on investigations that include potential violations to the appropriate agency certification of proper licenses and wage and hour enforcement. We are aware of other states working on this issue with similar multi-agency cooperation. We hope the state of Oregon will more formally make this an ongoing enforcement practice and consider cooperating with adjacent states. The state of Washington has conducted a study on these issues and the impacts and created a multi-agency approach to enforcement. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we hope you'll be able to take some action that will enable better enforcement around the issues presented on the economy. And as Mr. Puckett stated, we'd be more than willing to work independently with the different agencies to a little more detailed information. We appreciate the time this morning to give you this one small snapshot of the human problem that's out there and what we're dealing with. So we appreciate it. If you have any questions,
thank you both. I think you really highlighted that this problem isn't just about the contractors, but also about the hospitals and the workforce. And I think that's a pretty powerful video of some of the owners about the position to protect themselves from some of these unscrupulous and much say practices. Any questions from the committee? Thank you both very much for your testimony. I had up next Daniel Baldwin, but I don't know if he's still here.
Foundation, and I appreciate being able to take a little bit of time, especially during the summer. Some members of the committee probably are fishing or something like that. Report that's a little bit about the Oregon Southwest Washington Fair Contracting Foundation. We're a nonprofit 501c5 incorporated in the state of Oregon. We're dedicated to fairness in public works. We strive to level the playing field between responsible contractors and those who are gaining a competitive advantage by not following the rules. We're a labor management organization. We serve contractors who employ thousands, well over 10,000 workers in the construction field. We deal exclusively in the public works arena of the construction industry. Now, a lot of folks might suggest that, well, you know, with prevailing wage laws and all the scrutiny that the prevailing wage public works projects get, that you wouldn't really have that big of a problem with independent contractors or people working outside of the normal economy. Unfortunately, this is not the case. Although, with organizations like mine and also with the state agencies, having a bit more oversight is probably slightly less of a problem, and we still run into quite a bit. In other words, the dollars that you appropriate from your legislative actions for public works in the state of Oregon and the various jurisdictions, cities, counties, Department of Transportation, some of that money is going into feeding the underground economy. And it is a fairly extensive problem. I should also say that the Fair Contracting Foundation does not take a position for or against any legislation. We're completely neutral with regards to promoting or lobbying for legislation. However, we can provide information to you about issues that we encounter in the field, which is what I'm here to do today. The practices associated with the underground economy, that is, misclassification, non-payment of workman's comp, social security, and unemployment obligations, have a severe negative impact on our industry. And the part of the industry that I'm talking about in this case is the prevailing wage or the public works part of the construction industry. It impacts states' revenues, there are impacts on workers,
and there are impacts on responsible contractors. And I will deal with those three in my testimony. Impacts on state revenues. The impact on the state revenues, the tax avoidance schemes misclassification robs both the state and federal government of revenues. Estimates from the IRS indicate billions of dollars of tax dollars go unpaid each year because of misclassification alone throughout the United States. Now, I wasn't able to find any studies specific to the state of Oregon, but there's quite a few studies done out there on the impacts of the underground economy as far as states not being able to cover revenues for the various services that they provide. One of those was from Illinois and was a study which was funded by the National Organization of Fair Contracting Foundation, sort of an umbrella organization to which we belong and have access. Now, I'm going to mention two things here, and I can get them both to you if you would like. In electronic format, it's fairly long. I didn't have to come in for it. The Illinois study, the one that I'm referring to right now, found that in 2005, an estimated $53.7 million were lost for unpaid unemployment insurance taxes, $149 million to $250 million in loss of income tax. Now, Illinois is a little bit bigger of an economy than Oregon's, but not that much. What could you folks do in the legislature with another $250 million? So, by enforcing these rules to a greater extent and eliminating the underpayments for the that occur because of the underground economy would be beneficial, of course, to your budget situation. Also, there was $97.9 million, almost $100 million, not paid in workers' compensation premiums. And again, I can get that study to you if you like. Now, the impact on workers. Individually, when workers are misclassified as independent contractors or paid cash under the table or something like that, they could be subject to huge tax bills if they're caught in this or at the end of the year when they try to file as a 1099, they wind up finding that they owe a tremendous amount of money in taxes that they can't pay because it's supposed to be held from their paychecks. I mean, that's the whole idea behind withholding, right? Some of the other impacts that they might have are that they're denied Social Security benefits, unemployment benefits, and Medicare when they retire because no taxes were paid on their on their behalf. If they're injured on a job, they may not have access to workers' compensation. I'm going to get to a case of that that we discovered in a moment. Study commissioned by the Department of Labor in 2000 estimates that 80,000 workers are improperly denied unemployment benefits every year because they're misclassified as independent contractors. For my foundation, one of the biggest concerns that we have is for the contractors that fund us. We're funded primarily by both worker and contractor contributions. And the contractors that are interested in work, having us work for them are contractors that are legitimate, responsible contractors. And they have to compete with people who aren't willing to follow the rules sometimes, which is why they ask us to go up and look at this stuff. According to testimony on May 8, 2007, before the U.S. Federal House, the Congress House Ways and Means Committee, and a couple of subcommittees, employers who employ tax avoidance schemes can undercut responsible contractors by at least 20% and up to 30%, giving them a tremendous amount of competitive advantage. If you're if you're a general contractor and you look at the bids coming in and you've got a sub that's 20% lower than everybody else, quite often you're going to give that sub that contract unless you know something else that they can substantially work. But, you know, all things equal, you're going to give it to the low bid. And so these contractors are able to undercut legitimate contractors by as much as 30%. In the course of doing routine prevailing wage compliance investigations, the Fair Contracting Foundation has seen at least some evidence of the underground economy activity in virtually all construction trades, including electrical, plumbing, mechanical, drywall, floor covering, general labor, truck and munitions, just to name a few of the trades that we've seen in the underpayment of the underground economy in operation. Let me give you a couple of cases, and I'm not going to be too specific about these because of they are in the public record, but we don't need to mention names. One of the first investigations that I did as an investigator was in North Portland Health Clinic, a very interesting situation in which the contractor handed his workers certified payroll. Certified payroll is the document that the contractor is supposed to give to the state agency certifying that they have paid the prevailing wage on the project. This group of workers, up to 24 of them, were challenged in the area of being able to speak English. Being fluent in Spanish, I was able to interview these workers. A lot of them were itinerant, not necessarily here in the United States legally, but they were working on this project. There was also an immigration component to this type of thing. I'm not going to go into this, it's pretty obvious. At any rate, the contractor was handing these guys the certified payroll and having them sign that as if they were their paychecks, their time cards. They were using the certified payroll for their time cards and then signing at the bottom, thinking that this would be a way to get around that. And actually, it was fairly clever to have them do that. And since these workers didn't speak any English, they didn't really know what they were signing. Just that it was their paycheck, that's how they were going to get paid. And that resulted in a series of investigations following after that that accumulated in hundreds of thousands of dollars in back wages being paid on that project and others. Also a very large fine against that contractor to the Bureau of Labor Industry, which still hasn't been paid, $72,000 fine to the Bureau of Labor Industry, but this is just going out working on different project units and employing people in the underground economy. There was a case in where we did some work for the OECDD, the Oregon Economic Community Development Department, up in Redmond area, where there were a number of excavation contractors that were operating independently. Hillsdale Water Reservoir, where there was a group of workers who had been brought in from out of state that were working on Saturdays, getting paid under the table. We were able to stop that. There was a current investigation with an HVAC contractor up in the Bend area. I'm not going to tell you which project that was at this time because it is an ongoing investigation. Four independent contractors working together to do the HVAC system up there under the auspices of another independent contractor. Current investigation also, there was a worker recently fired in the... off another project in Bend where he had gotten injured and wanted to go get workman's comp. He had been, didn't realize he was at his family joint, didn't realize that he didn't have any access to the workman's comp system. When he complained about it, he was fired on the team desk. And there's just dozens of these kinds of cases that I could point out. We routinely inform several agencies of things that we find in our investigations, but this is kind of an ad hoc thing. So that if we have an issue that's this bully issue with prevailing wage, we might also, in our judgment, think that there's something for Oregon Revenue, possibly for the IRS, possibly a workman's comp issue, and we will take these to the individual agencies. But seldom is there a joint group, and it would be of great interest to my foundation as far as being able to take these sort of issues to a government agency. If there was a working group of the Bureau of Labor Ministries, Oregon Revenue, Workman's Comp, and CCB, and possibly other agencies working together on a formal basis. Now, a recent case that we closed on our end, which was up at the Clatsop County Courthouse, I asked one of our investigators to follow up on that, and he did find that last June, several of those agencies did get together, but it was a fairly informal thing. They got their information on the case that we had filed, and then they went their separate ways, and we hadn't wanted to this one to happen as far as that. Kind of unfortunate, we can't track that. So, our hope is that for the continuous efforts in trying to bring the enforcement level, as was stated earlier, you know, the laws are good that we have here. We just need more enforcement. One of the ways we can have enforcement would be to have a joint task force that the citizens groups like mine can go to on a phone basis. Any other questions?
Thank you. You made one statement that just kind of caught my attention about when you turn these cases over to a state agency. There is no follow-up after that, so you don't know really what happened in those cases until, I would assume that there's eventually a public record or something, but I'm kind of interested in why there is no follow-up, and maybe the agencies can probably answer that for me once they do.
Actually,
I mean, how do you know the agency's doing its job? Maybe they are doing their job and you just don't know it.
Well, actually, so it depends on the agency. The Bureau of Labor Industries, once they conclude an investigation, everything they do is on the public record, and they do inform us of the results of the investigations that we filed with them. Workers' Comp also, and CCD also. These agencies don't have a kind of privacy restriction. However, once you get to Oregon Revenue and unemployment, I can certainly understand there being certain privacy issues, and so we just kind of get a pat on the back and go from there. We don't really know what the result is of our investigations, but often with the other three agencies I mentioned, is we could have all of them.
Thanks for shedding a little more light on this issue across residential and commercial and how public works projects. And I think that's my lead in. I really appreciate the agencies that are here who've been waiting patiently, listening. We'll wait till we get done with the other agencies. Mr. Long, are you under a huge time constraint right now?
Oh, great.
Then sit back and enjoy the testimony from some other folks.
So could I have up Jack Young, Rob Edwards, and Gary Manning?
And so I purposely, made you sit through all of this, unfortunately. I could have warned you, I suppose, ahead of time. I really did want the agencies to listen to the dialogue and, to the different aspects that we're talking about around this issue. And, from last session, we did a lot of work on construction contractor issues. And, we kept coming, circling this particular issue of the underground economy and people that aren't technically employees, but they're being treated as independent contractors sometimes. And, this issue just seems to meld into a lot of other problems. I'm aware of this particular steering committee looking at this issue from a multi-agency perspective, which I find very encouraging, especially after listening to all the ramifications of this issue. So I'm just going to leave it to you to tell us a little bit about the state agency's perspective on what's going on and what your particular departments are able to do about it and what you're
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jack O'Connell. I'm the Department of Revenue and Business Division Administrator. And today I'm joined by Gary Manahan, who's the Workers' Comp Division, Department of Consumer and Business Services, Rob Edwards, the Employment Department, and also Dan Mack, who's also the Department of Revenue. And my colleagues and I are here to provide a status report on the Independent Contractor Steering Committee, And for those of you who don't know, the Independent Contractor Steering Committee was formed in 2005 to actually engage in joint rulemaking to implement a common definition of the term independent contractor. Following implementation of the rule, the agencies agreed that we needed to continue working together and collaborating in the areas of enforcement and outreach. And I think it was very clear from the legislation that passed in 2005 that that was the legislative implementation. So today, we're going to talk a little bit about the importance of the collaborative enforcement efforts and outreach. I think Deanna and Jerry are going to talk first about the enforcement efforts.
Sharing and finding from our investigative efforts,
And we do find quite a few cases where that can happen. Unlicensed contractor working, that never sometimes comes to work conservation and climate development. We're also trying to carry some of the climate change area. So we're getting better at doing that and get through it. Another tool that we've been using in the last probably year and a half, 2 years, is what we call a SLEEP. And what a SLEEP is really an interagency collaborative effort where we bring the agency investigators together. And we target a specific area or zone where we perceive there may be a problem. An example is we've gone into Central Oregon, in Portland, Connecticut, on the Oregon coast, where we'll take one investigative group, we have 17 investigators from various different agencies. We went into construction zones. We looked at 200 different businesses. And the different agencies, based on their expertise, were able to go in teams to identify whether or not the contractors and businesses working on those job sites are within climate control rules. We found evidence in some cases where they didn't have coverage, cases where they may not have had the proper licensure and certifications for the fishing sites, similar to the tax areas. But each of our agencies have different layers or levels of due process, if you will. Or if we have findings, then we each have to just order separately. And then those each of those violations of findings that we have will follow the respective set of laws as well. So you could end up with five cases under one order. I'd say for both efforts are continuing as we look forward. We have another one planned here later this fall. And these are totally unannounced. We're working backdrops and put things together. Our government coast division, as we suggest, going there, a big one there, I'd say about a year for it. It gives a very good result. And the other thing it does, it provides great return on investment. It's not necessarily sometimes exactly what you find, but behind a lot of people know that we're out there, that we will be coming into the sites. It does provide a great return for people to make sure they have a component. And again, it's just another way in which we can work better together. We're learning as we go through the process. We do have some research regarding confidentiality. Once we get information, we can and can't share it with anyone. It was confidence. Type of information, most of that is public record as we go through it. The payroll system seems to be an area where it's almost no confidence. And we're done. We're glad to get some justice on that.
Well, it seems, the one thing that's in my mind is, it sounds like, we're moving in a good direction of trying to look at some of these issues, but it also, I got an email from somebody during other testimony with people who are out in the industry who maybe don't see your sleeps or know a lot about what's going on with the agency in this regard, and they're really not seeing the impact in their industry yet. Obviously, this task force hasn't been around or worked with on this issue, hasn't been around a while. And especially around the enforcement, it seems that talking to people on the road where construction sites and find issues. You have the records and you have the ability to do that. I'm just wondering, are there impediments that keep this particular group or this multi-agency approach to trying to help bring this industry into compliance? What are the impediments to you actually succeeding at doing this more aggressively than perhaps you have seen? Or are there?
I think part of it is the establishing priorities of the program. Let's say these are agencies put a tremendous amount of resources into the enforcement area.
I think part of it is just kind of focusing a little better on the interagency aspect. I can only really speak for the past division regarding activities we have. We do over 10,000 investigations. I know some of the other agencies do thousands, 5,000 contacts with the industry. So I think the impediment is having all this information and trying to listen to each other. We're out there on the street, but maybe we're not communicating on how that's going to things that we can do. And to me, it's a growing process where we're trying to learn best practices with one another. What is it that we're doing with each other and that so we can work better?
Yes, so do you find, as far as that goes, the agency that you work for, is there anything that is also the energy and the FTEs, I guess, to make this a more successful program, collaboration, and enforcement? Just I'm kind of interested in where the agencies see this approach going. Do they see expanding it? Do they see utilizing it more than what they have in the past? Or do they see it as something that is just
members, hey Rob Edwards from the Employment Department. Just to kind of follow up on what Jerry was saying too, I think one of the other issues with the Johns and Sweet just in order with Facebook, I mentioned 17 investigators. And all of these folks have their regular job interviews too, so trying to coordinate a client where 17 of them can wait for you to take a day or 2 days or 3 days to do this is sometimes difficult. So that's just kind of something that I'm looking at. I know for the tax section of the employment department, we love to do it. We'd like to do more of that. Under our federal requirements, we are required to do what's called a 2% percentage trade plan. We're required to audit 2% of the active employers in Oregon. So that means we have 44 auditors that have to do a certain number of audits every year. So we do have to try and open the resources so that we don't get involved in things that don't take away from the federal. So that's kind of the limitation of that.
The committee, correct. The Department of Revenue, I believe, issue one of the challenges is also a resource allocation. We have a number of tax programs that we administer, for instance, tax programs, separate tax programs that we administer. So it's a matter of allocating the resources to all the challenges. Naturally, we believe that any kind of income is expense foundation from the workforce from the client connection to the client. So we have to not nearly enough to eliminate the discount.
So that just brings to mind to me is that I know that previously mentioned there's been studies in other states in the city of Washington just about the uncollected revenue that's out there. It seems like the activity in this arena will virtually pay for itself, potentially. Certainly it's not going to do that off the start, but it certainly seems like it has potential to add revenue back into the system if we goes once it comes back in, but certainly it seems like it would be a good investment of state resources to ultimately collect some more resources from people that ought to be paying and help level the playing field, so to speak, in this industry, so that the government folks can keep their money and work with other people. So I'm just kind of curious what the next step is, and it sounds like what I'm hearing is anybody likes the program or wants to continue the collaboration on this kind of enforcement, but some direction from the legislature on resource direction further would be another discussion to have and potentially already see if this program more formally work on these issues. You're saying it's sort of a correct 2000 assessment.
Okay.
think it's recognized that there is a problem out there in the industry. Much of it is unreported. People don't file complaints, and oftentimes those complaints are very difficult to ascertain if there's a violation or not. Truck drivers have to count the failures and sort of all that out. It's a lot of their time for the industry and the state. Again, I don't know if you have any other comments to make for us.
One of the other things that I think is legal is more of a balanced approach to administration of the tax system. And in addition to what we do have, lending outreach actually do a good deal of collaborating on to make sure that people entering the industry understand what they're coming for and provide efforts for the employment department to have a good.
Very briefly, the subcommittee will turn the contract to the application reach work group, which has done several items. It's produced several products, one of which is a separate website on independent contractors, what the definition is, who's the worker, who's an independent contractor. We wanted that housed separately rather than under just one agency, just to give people more of an idea that this is something that goes across agencies. Produced that brochure, which I believe copies are available, called Independent Employee or Independent Contractor, which goes over some of the same material that's on the website. We're working on a 12-minute long flash video, which again goes over the definition of independent contractor versus employee. Ongoing state publication of the Oregon Business Guide, which are the definitions and descriptions in there are fully accurate. And we also state staff statewide presentations on the independent contractor for organizations like the National Association of Tax Consultants and Community Colleges. We utilize the resources available to the state library, creating a payroll tax listserv. It's an email service that actually the Department of Revenue sends periodic newsletters. And in addition to the link provided on the independent contractor website, the Department of Revenue has also established an email address for employers to submit questions, as well as to import conforming information to state factory if people are seeing things that are going on and they don't think it's right for the detail with the information.
Thank you. I appreciate your report. Sounds like on the job, and hopefully that job will disappear on us. And also, I hope that you recognize that though this group, known as specifically the independent contractor work group, the different agencies, I know that are aware that you know, there's a lot of different issues that pop up that may are related, but may not be directly involved with whether or not they're in contact or not. Part of that is whether people get paid by employers, their taxes on the employee, and whether they get paid by employees. So I think that they're part of that. I'm really excited about that kind of thing. I appreciate all your work. Thank you very much. And briefly, I had on my agenda Mark Long, and I see that he came in. If you'd like to come up, Mark, you started out the morning with CCB, sort of going over the state of the construction contractor board and relationship to much of the legislation we passed in the last session and over the construction tax task force. As you know, I've gotten another communication from Eric Grassberger, the chair, and I guess I'll just listen to him to get into the record. Okay. Well, you know, just this is coming full circle now back to when we're looking. involved in the construction industry and, you know, the consumers being at risk. And he being the chair of that committee was not all that positive that we left a few things on the table in the last session as much as we did. And I know this committee probably could spend more time on construction than we ever possibly could. He did, you know, have some issues with the left the building envelope, the tape twice, you know, issue on the wind situation and the assistance fund being three that really stood out to me. I know the CCE and the coordination with their home builders and things others have really stepped up to try to do some contractor education on the building envelope, which frankly was some testimony. Step in the direction and that education will hopefully trickle down to people that are actually installing the product around the building envelope. Barry Grassberger continues to voice his concerns on some of those issues around the actual installers knowing what they're doing when it comes to the building envelope and the legislation and the rules for drinking out around that don't directly address that. And we're also just sort of getting a broader view of the whole industry, potentially looking at legislation coming forward or not, trying to make a decision on whether it's going to be appreciated committee. So, Mark, thank you very much for all your work in this arena. I'm just going to give you the liberty to talk about whatever aspect of the construction industry, licensed contractors, or construction claims task force issues that you see that are still, I guess, out there.
For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes, I do have a handout for you, and I know that when we met in February, I did provide an update. Kind of a legislative wrap-up on the task force. I won't go into detail all the recommendations and the status, but since February, kind of back at Building Codes, as a result of the recommendations, we were tasked to accomplish some things that were part of the report, and I've highlighted those for you. I'm happy to say that everything's been implemented and it's effective. July 1 was the last kind of trigger date of this year that we had on our pieces. You can see the moisture content. And this is where I'm kind of making sure. Let me back up. There are the issues of the criteria and the worker and the consumer protection. I'll talk about those in a little bit. But then on the building code side, there are the issues of how do you keep water out or how do you keep the home built right the first time with the structure. And then if you do get moisture in there, which was one of the issues we were really trying to tackle with the construction claims task force, how to get it out of it. So a couple things. Moisture content, make sure you're not using wet wood. Believe it or not, in Oregon and nationally, there wasn't a standard for residential construction. A lot of builders did the right thing. Best practices. We used dried the wood out, dried their homes out before coverage, but it wasn't a code requirement. Now it's a code requirement. So hopefully we'll see some improvement in that area. Believe it or not, we didn't have a very good standard around flashing and kind of keep the water out. Ventilation. Now we think we're going to get water in the building either through what the occupants do or some kind of potential problem. We've increased the ventilation. Believe it or not, your arranger wasn't required to exhaust to the outside. To protect it from burning, but not from ventilation. So now we require ventilation, and you can see what we've done in the bathrooms and whatnot. Rain drain or envelope rain drain, this is the whole idea, and I'm sure the chair recalls the discussion that we had over EECS. I can't remember what that acronym stands for specifically, but that's the EECS. Some people call it synthetic stucco generic, and I know others object to that definition, but most consumers, that's what they call it. We had a lot of discussion about making sure we had the right type of EECS product. It had a barrier built in so water could drain out. Well, on regular construction, we are not using EECS. We need to make sure that we have kind of that drain barrier. And if we've got that, as well, I think it has that. And then some of the other issues around the certificate of occupancy, I know the chair was interested on, trying to identify who some of the contractors were, so if the consumers were aware of that. There's obviously licensing enforcement and competency issues, and so we put in place in Oregon a certificate of occupancy requirement for residential construction on a statewide basis that wasn't there before. And we ask for, although a limited list, but we do ask for some of the team generals and subs that work on that system. And then the last thing that we started with, not necessarily come out of the task force specifically, but it's public information. We have a kind of a permit to protect the trademark, a public campaign outreach effort. And I just provided you an example of one of them where we talk about preventing mold related to ventilation for your bathrooms and kitchens based on the new screen. So this is kind of the wrap-up of the construction plans task force. All of the administrative issues that the task force recommended and implemented for the Building Codes Division. Obviously, there were some legislative things that didn't occur, which is fine. And then all the other pieces, are credited with the money. Overall, we talked about enforcement. Let me just share with you some of the thoughts that we have. When I have 40-some licensed individuals I regulate, they're the specialty trades, electricians, plumbers, folks work on boilers, elevators, and then our local government inspectors. One other thing, I don't know if this is germane to independent contractors or not, but I can tell you, especially in the electrical area, that some of the license plates aren't clear standards. It isn't clear who can do what work and what license I need to do what work. Well, when there aren't clear standards, then there tends to be gaps in enforcement. People don't understand it, so it's not enforced. People might navigate their way through and not understand what they're supposed to do, and so you end up with a problem. So if you're dealing with independent contracting and the other issues, I don't know if the standards are clear. I know they've worked on them, but you got to have clear standards. The other thing you have to have is timely action. When I took over the division, we had a 4-page enforcement document. If you were expecting either a citizen or a local government person who's helping us with enforcement or our staff fill out in triplicate and a whole bunch of copies and whatnot, it probably would take 2 hours to fill out the form. And then maybe 6 months later, you mail it to the offending individual, and then maybe a year later, you take action. I don't think that works. I never work with my kids. I don't think it works in enforcement. So we developed a citation book. And my premise was that for a fairly major event, driving around a complicated, you can find out what you did wrong and get a notice served on you relatively quickly. But if you violate one of our contractor laws, it's going to take a 4-part form. It's going to go on forever. And there's a delay. So we created a citation typically based on what the state police use. And we didn't have the ability to instantly give that to a contractor who wasn't kind of an electrical license or plumbing license or things that I remember. And that has proven to be a very useful tool because I have the ticket and directly witness the intention of the to appeal it as well. Talk about sweeps. Sweeps are a good tool. I think they're current. Working together with the other agencies to leverage information. I don't know if folks talked to you about it when we did the multi-agency sweeps. It was interesting. If you look at the 5 or 6 agencies that were involved, many of the cases ended up being revenue cases because of the tax issues, as opposed to an individual building code license issue or a CCD license issue or a worker comp issue, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of interesting. Tips. Got to figure out a network to get out there and do it. And I have 6 enforcement folks, and they mentioned they have 44. I don't know what workers' comp has. I don't know if CCD had 14, 15 last session. Difficult to cover the whole state, so you got to leverage resources with other entities, and you do that partnering with local government. And you actually help work with the industry to help police itself. Because most good contractors, like all of them, have an interest in making sure that they're following the standards of everybody else's. Another thing that you've got to look at is multiple tools in the toolbox. When I go to the division, we kind of have a one-size-fits-all approach for enforcement actions, and I don't think that works. And we have kind of a range of sanctions where you can look at fines, you can look at suspensions, you can look at certain conditions, you can look at revocations, you can direct training, you can do a whole bunch of different things to kind of bring somebody into the fold. And so If folks know that it's going to be very difficult for you to suspend the license, and if your choice is to greenlight what I call either a one letter penalty, makes it difficult to get to the issue. And so that folks know. And you need to communicate the results. One of the things that we still don't do very good that we're going to be working on is when you do take action and you've been successful solving the problem is the public's aware of it. Tell you a very quick story. We were working with a contractor who didn't have the right license and couldn't get permits for a life safety system, fire alarm protection system in school. Very serious thing. And we're still doing work in the community where we got a whole lot of news media and made folks aware that it was unlicensed permits. And about 2 or 3 weeks we came to our office and said, all right, what do I need to do? How do I get back on the program? So that was very useful for us to look at getting the information out to the results. And then the last thing is public awareness. And through our Permit to Protect campaign is to get consumers to help them, and if you see kind of our logo here, is to help them understand this is about a code issue, but we also do it on licensing and enforcement issues. Help them understand that we can train workers and follow the standards, help to protect the safety and value of the business, and keep them in the folks that are using the standards. And then you talk about resources, and all state agencies are going to become involved in resources. I would first focus on the other 6 items. First, when you do enforcement, whether it's at the independent contractor level, general contractor level, subcontractor level, or last thing I'll touch on, and you may have some questions. You asked what's out there related to construction claims. You mentioned the lien issue. Obviously, there's been some news media around the double pay problem. It seems like that's the high end issue to discuss. I don't know what the solution is. I understand that lien laws are pretty complicated for the system. We could talk about the system turning. I haven't heard folks talking about them. That was what I thought is a task force staff, a fairly simple concept that got fairly complicated. The one thing we didn't mention that folks are talking about is the warranty. I know some contractors are interested in that, but it's really, I don't know how you're going to solve it, Mr. Chair, but there's this whole issue of kind of a double jeopardy. We recall during the session where if you create a warranty and say, all right, you're going to step up and be accountable to this warranty and put the standards in there. But then, if it's outside of the warranty, you're still subject to the statute of repose. That creates a difficult situation for contractors to say, all right, I'm willing to sign up here and meet a certain standard, but then anything else, I'm still subject to. That's a complication. That's what I see. It's a challenge for someone to walk away to a truly robust third party. Training and education is the area that we're focusing on. The sheriff, I know Craig is working on that. We have equipment at Building Codes now where we are providing, which isn't directed at CCTF issue necessarily, web-based training for our regulated community, our inspectors. And what we have found is that the state's able to provide a little bit greater leadership. But before we took these actions, most of the training was occurring at the local government level by local government affiliates. And the training was really about code, which is fun. What we've been able to do is bring folks in through a web-based platform, which has all kinds of benefits for that. But working with the instructors under a state umbrella, they're actually able to talk about this, be asked them to talk about the CCTF issues and the moisture issues and the envelope issues and the legislation so that the regulators could have a greater role of inspectors in thinking through these issues out in the job sector. So we're very excited about using web-based technology to get this information to the folks that are actually out in the field as well. So I've covered kind of the administrative pieces that we've done to implement, and I feel from task force recommendation that we've resolved the administrative pieces, obviously lots of work to do. Talked to you about kind of the general enforcement things that we're working on where we are licenses, and what I see is just kind of issues that we're and I guess I'll share with you this. You know, we see increased interest in these issues as we have a huge ramp up in construction activity, and then you see it on the ramp down side. Really nice, and I'm sure folks would like it, but it's kind of perfect long enough. at a stable level of construction. I can show you my revenue numbers over 5 years. Okay, so it's up. But you see things on the top and bottom. There's some questions. How do you get out in front on the ramp up? With that, take the questions.
Thank you, Mark, for showing up and giving us your perspective.
I apologize for the conflict.
I was in the wrong place.
Oh, that's nice.
Nice and clean. So I just had a question in there, the certificate of occupancy was going to ask me a little bit of issues around that, but it always seemed like a good idea to me that a homeowner and get a list of people who work on the property, and then there's some issues around who's responsible and who had the contract with them and all that. But you did expand the submission of that information for the general contractor, electrical, plumbing, and HVAC. And I guess the question is, why not the rest of the
license? Sure, as you were getting to ask that question, I was trying to recall. Let me first share with you that you proposed a more robust list as part of the rulemaking effort. And there were some legitimate concerns that came forward from the construction community as well as the local government community. And I just sit here and cannot remember the specifics of what those issues were. And so as we went through and with the goal of getting this in place by April, which we were working on this in January and February, we had a tight timeline because that's when the code changed. And I thought it was good to get it at the time we were making the code changes. This was what we were able to do.
Well, obviously, it's important to have an electrical plumbing contractor available. And there's a lot of other subcontracts on the
You're bringing up what I recall, that the general wanted to be contacted to solve the problem. I think, if I'm not mistaken, is that information is available to the general through CCD. They have to provide it when there's an issue with the subcontractor. So, again, kind of getting all the testimony, and I think we had a couple different public hearings on this. There's been quite a bit of discussion. We felt that this was the best first step. First getting the CFO, getting it tied to the code and these other consumer protection measures, and then getting some required contract information.
I'd also be interested to hear from you at a later date and perhaps share with you something that we did ask and if there are problems that all come to life and that's not a conversation that's important for us to hear back.
Data. We don't have a very good handle on data about the size of the problem and scope and where the problem pressure points are, whether it's on the insurance claim side, you know, litigation occurs outside of the kind of the government umbrella of CCB or just what consumers are facing. And I know we spent some time on a data bill that wasn't successful at the end. Absent data, I can tell you anecdotally, when we hear things from, whether it's from Eric or other attorneys, they say nothing's changed. I don't know if that's a fair representation of the world out there. We know that most of the folks try to do a good job, and we know that when something goes bad, it goes really bad. But I guess I would encourage, in addition to those other things I talked about, if you're doing enforcement, it's clear. It's awfully hard to solve a problem if you don't have a handle on the scope and the pressure. It wasn't easy.
we hear from people in the industry of the problems. A lot of tasks can go on, so for say agencies to have an issue out there sometimes, and when there is, sometimes there isn't.
Association. I didn't want to bring one quick thing to your names at the time, but I've been fascinated listening to your discussion this morning about the problems of the construction industry and making sure that the high quality work can be for consumers. There's an issue that's going to be on the ballot this fall that's going to put all that in enormous jeopardy, and not many people are aware of it. It doesn't have a ballot number yet, insofar as I know. It's initially ballot number 21 that says that if you have a project less than $35,000 value, that you don't have to get a building permit. Typically, it is a grapple with the size more without talking about it, obviously. And typically, the size of the project, there's a lot of bad drafting in it. One of the major problems in it is that they use the word $35,000 value. Now, nobody knows what that concept value. But if you take a look at what happens after a remodeling project, if you have a job that costs $35,000, it likely will not raise the value of your home $35,000. You probably have to do a $100,000 job to make the value of your home go up $35,000. So that's the word from the initiative. The passes we could have then a huge percentage of our work not requiring permits. And all this talk about who is licensed and who is not licensed, the major place where you catch that is in the permit scheme, because you can't get a permit if you're not licensed. And so if we eliminate permits, or a few percent, perhaps as much as half of the building permits in the United States, we're going to eliminate inspections, we're going to eliminate the license. It's very, very dangerous for the safety of the public and really working with them as well as for our industry. And we're hoping for constant insistence about this. It sounds not that bad on its face. Somebody wants to do a little project and have something done small in the house, right to the after the building permit process. There's good reason for it. And if this is not just for the project, it's for the project.
Thank you for making us aware of that. Issues that people really need to look at closely.
There's a coalition of interest groups, insurance people and contractors, and means a lot of folks. There's lots and lots of very broad groups because of our impact. So we'll be needing some information to be posted to the center to see if we can actually.
for the record, Scott Perry with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and along with Mr. Corey, our organization is also on that work group that's opposing Measure 21. But in addition to that, I just wanted to add a few more comments about some of the testimony. I did want to comment that we have many unlicensed members in our organization because we have many unlicensed or non-licensed fields from interior design all the way through. So there are thousands of non-licensed members in the Home Builders Organization. Certainly, looking to the actual number of folks who are supported in contractors, whether or not that's a big deal and a big issue for our association. We try to set ourselves apart, certainly. And again, for record, Mr. Dan, there's not a lot left for the organization. Just one last comment. The Oregon Home Builders Association actually brought in House Bill 2178 and in fact the task force we pushed for it. We were concerned about what was going on in the industry with water intrusion getting into houses and causing construction defects. We pushed for continuing education and additional enforcement. We asked even for the CFO and the benefits that we thought that might bring. So I just want to make sure that for the record, the members of the community understand that we are certainly pushing hard for getting our membership and in some cases dragging those who are not interested in some more professional situation.
Thank you, questions? Thank you very much. Thank all those who attended, provided testimony, and even those who came to listen. I appreciate everybody's interest in this subject matter. I'm afraid to contact here. Obviously, if you're concerned about, this is a good time to do that if you're thinking about what kind of legislation may be needed for Oregon in 2009. So, with that, any announcements? Thank you to my committee administrator and staff out here, working diligently to make me successful. And with that, I'd like to adjourn the House Hearing Committee.